Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. After 15 years of conflict in the Middle East, the political turmoil and the violence in the region has never been higher. And yet the U.S. role in stabilizing the conflicts has never been more ambivalent. My guest today is one of the U.S.'s most decorated diplomats, a career Foreign Service officer who is credited with some success in tamping down violence in both Iraq and Afghanistan during his work in those countries. Over the past 25 years, Ambassador Ryan Crocker has served in some of the Middle East's most unstable regions. He served as ambassador to Lebanon, to Kuwait, to Syria, Pakistan, Iraq, and then called out of retirement to serve his most recent post, ambassador to Afghanistan, in 2011 and 2012. He has received many of the nation's highest honors, including the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian award, Presidential Distinguished Service Award, the State Department's Distinguished Service Award, the Department of Defense's Distinguished Civilian Service Award, the State Department's Distinguished Honor Award, and the list goes on and on. He spoke to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last week in a talk titled Middle East Meltdown and spoke candidly about the U.S.'s abdication of its leadership role both in Syria and the civil war there and the region as a whole. I spoke with him while he was in here in Tulsa. Ambassador Crocker, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, thanks very much for having me.
As we talk now, the Assad regime has captured Aleppo with all the horrific scenes we saw and the final capture of this city and the brutal scenes of the siege. Where does this leave us in terms of the Syrian civil war? When you look at a map of Syria, the Syrian government controls most of the cities. There's areas that the anti-Assad government insurgency holds, sometimes very close to even cities like Damascus. And then there are swaths that ISIS or ISIL controls as well. But really, when you look at the cities of Syria, it's mostly controlled by the Assad government at this point, isn't it?
That's exactly right. About the only major city left in rebel control, that's Idlib, and that isn't much of a city. So it's a huge problem. You chronicled it very well. But what we're seeing now on the ground is in no small part the consequence of an administration that never had a policy. So President Trump is going to have to take this on, and it is going to be the problem from hell. The other thing to keep in mind here, there are no quick ends to civil wars. The Lebanese civil war, I spent 6 years of my life going through that, lasted 15 years. We're just moving into year six here, and it is a much more complex problem. So without a new administration with an actual policy, this is not going to get better. It's going to get worse.
One of the things you've said is that what characterizes the Obama administration when it came to reacting to what happened in the Arab Spring and the aftermath was that we had tactics, but no strategy. Can you explain what that means?
There has been no strategy, obviously. That has been the fallback position for the Obama administration. Don't get sucked in. Don't get rug in. Keep as low a profile as you can, and trust the freedom-loving people of the region to do the right thing. That is so idiotic as to beggar comment. This is a region that has known nothing but authoritarianism of one form or another. There is no history of democratic institutions or practices. So if you're going to sit back and say, we don't need a policy, others will move in and construct one, as we have seen, not just in Syria, also in Iraq.
And in this, in the Syria's case, it's Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're right that we were sucked in the Middle East, and the Obama administration did inherit a lot of the issues involved. But it seems like to me the guiding light of it was that the American people were really tired of entering into more foreign adventures, if you will, like Syria, like probably even Libya, to that matter. Is that just not an option for the United States?
It's a great question, Rich. I am a big history freak. There was no academic discipline that was more relevant to me as a serving officer than history. So here's some history. World War I ends in 1918. There is a Middle East dimension to the follow-on constructs, basically involving France and Britain splitting up the region among them and creating these mandates. Woodrow Wilson wanted to play, but by that time his health was starting to fail him. The Brits and the French had very sharp elbows to keep him out of the room. And then, of course, the 1918 congressional election, which returned a not just a conservative majority, but an isolationist majority. Couldn't get the League of Nations through that, so we moved back into the shadows. So what happens next? 2 decades later, there is another big old war. Could Wilson have prevented it? Very possibly, because the main tag on that was a German humiliation. What was intended to keep Germany weak actually just pissed off the Germans and led to the rise of Hitler and the rest, as they say, is history.
And when you look at the Middle East, you also look at the fact that you had an Arab revolt as part of World War I, in which at least promises were ascertained that there would be some self-governance. And when that didn't happen after World War I, did that add to what becomes the tenuous nature of the Middle East today?
It certainly was a part of it. Some refer to the Palestinian area, now largely Israeli, as the thrice promised land. The other promises, well, let's see. This area cannot possibly achieve independence. The West is going to have to rule it. So one of those promises was Sykes-Picot, 1916, mm-hmm. when the French and the British literally carved up the region. A second part of that was the Hussein-McMahon Accords, an exchange of letters in the latter part of World War I, in which the British effectively promised Hussein of the Hejaz an independent Arab state to his north. The third promise, of course, was the Balfour Declaration.
Mm-hmm.
So in a world used to major league industrial strength double crosses, they got a triple cross.
Triple cross, right. So getting back to our initial question of where does this leave the Syrian conflict, Aleppo was a major victory for the Assad government. It's also a major victory for the Russians that have been allied with the Assad government. Do you anticipate that the conflict will still continue? As you mentioned, you said Lebanon lasted 15 years, and it was fewer people involved in the game than Syria. Do you expect this to continue to be an active conflict zone for another 5 to 10 years?
I absolutely do. And even if the next administration wanted to move aggressively in Syria, our options are few and largely bad. If we had moved earlier, different story perhaps. But as I look ahead, it's pretty darn bleak. I got to tell you just one anecdote, why there is always hope, even in the darkest moments. Until August, I was the dean of the Bush School of Government and Public Service at A&M. We got an application last year from a young woman who is not only Syrian, she lives in Syria. So we put together a full ride for her, and she's mm-hmm. on campus right now. Her reasons for wanting to come to the Bush School largely were that someday this war will end. All wars end. So will this one. She wants to have the skills, the experience. She's already got the ability to be part of a rebuilding of Syria on much firmer foundations than you have now. So the backlash to a civil war can actually give you something to work with going forward.
Has the U.S. really, I mean, one of the things you've talked about is we've totally checked out of the region. We've ceded our influence on this region. Will it be easy to regain that influence?
Once you've given away something, particularly in the Middle East, it's darn hard to get it back. So in Syria, you have this god-awful, bloody, literally, mess, particularly on the opposition side. Ironic that only the regime, Alawi minority, and the extremist Islamists, you know, they got a plan.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to take us a very long time to rebuild from that. I mean, if I were advising the president-elect, I'd say get it up on the screen. Otherwise, it is going to just spiral right down the sink. And you are going to be distracted. It's going to eat up your national security team's time. So pay attention. And attention, in my mind, would be something that we Americans don't do well.
No, we don't.
Strategic patience and consultation with those in this conflict. One thing I do not foresee is the Russians assuming a much larger role than they have now.
Really? Why is that? I mean, we've always think of Syria as being part of their sphere of influence going back to Cold War days. Why wouldn't they take a larger role?
Because they can't afford it.
Simple as that?
Simple as that. Putin would do it if he could, but it could be at the risk of a collapse in Russia. So I would wager he will not.
Is the regime that unsteady? The Russian regime?
Right.
Yeah.
The society, and in particular the economy are, yes, very much that unsteady. So I'm fond of saying that Putin played a really bad hand in Syria brilliantly. He didn't see an opportunity that led to his deployment of Russian forces. He saw a threat that if they did not come in, Assad could go down, and he is the only friend they got in the region. So it was a defensive decision on the part of Russia. What was our position? Well, if Putin played a bad hand brilliantly, we didn't even buy in at the table.
Now, what would have been the proper steps at the beginning of when this conflict began, when the Arab Spring spread to Syria? What would have been the best first steps? I know at one point I've read that you advised President Obama that we probably didn't have the wherewithal to support an opposition to overthrow the government. We probably should just quietly try to work with Assad.
And he, of course, made that impossible by his outrageous crimes. Nobody could work with him now except, of course, the Russians and the Iranians.
I'm talking about Assad. Yeah.
So what could we have done differently? Well, first, don't do stupid things. As the president, our president, is fond of saying, a really stupid thing in the world I come out of, international diplomacy, is to stake out a bold policy without thinking through how you're going to implement it. So that great Assad must go moment, for those of us who know the country, I just shook my head. Assad isn't going. And we don't have the wherewithal to force him to go.
Why would you think that Assad would not go? What's the history that would suggest that Assad would not say, hey, let me raid the treasury, take off, and leave?
Because of the unique conditions of the Syrian civil war. The Assad regime is a minority Alawite regime split off from Shia Islam. It's one of the reasons they've been able to hang in there. They know they are literally fighting for their lives. If the regime goes down, it is going to be hunting season for years on the whole Alawi community. So they'll rally to Assad.
This is an existential threat to them.
Absolutely. That's a much misused word, but that is exactly appropriate.
And so, and I've read where you said, you know, one of the things we need to know from history is that not the current Assad, but the elder Assad had an uprising, and he put it down pretty forcefully, completely put it down, but he also killed 25,000 civilians in the putting down of that rebellion. And knowing that, he created a security state that was so interlocked that it would be, as you put it, very, very difficult for an opposition to grow and to really thrive, given the security state they put in place.
I am so glad that you raised that point. You're talking about Hama, Syria's fourth largest city, and how the elder Assad dealt with it. He was having a significant problem with the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood. They got cornered in Hama's old city, so the Syrian regime just encircled it with artillery and armor, and as you correctly point out, they took the city back at an astronomical price in human lives. Why is this important? Again, you touched on that. Unlike Mubarak, unlike Gaddafi, unlike Ben Ali in Tunisia, Assad, father and son, knew that someday there might be a Sunni payback. I was just talking about the sectarian split. The forces that reduced Hama were basically all Alawi. The 25,000 who died were all Sunnis. So Assad knew this might come back to bite. He and his son spent the next three decades building the perfect security state, interlocking security and intelligence networks, playing different leaders off against each other, being absolutely brutal when he needed to be to see that the Brotherhood did not come back. So what happened in 1982 led directly to what we're looking at today.
Now, I think somebody might say, well, given the fact that we have this multi-pronged civil war in Syria, would suggest that that security system wasn't as tightly interlocked as we expect. But are elements still in place that would sort of ensure that Assad's going to survive to an extent?
Yeah, absolutely. The basic structure is still there. And that's why, as you pointed out earlier, possession of the cities is so important. I mean, that is where strategic strength lies. And Assad and the Russians and the Iranians have built a policy on that and have been quite effective in carrying it through.
I think the conventional wisdom is that the Assad government will move on to the next city that is held by insurgency forces. Is that a foregone conclusion? And when you look at, you know, a map of Syria, when you look at, say, for ISIS, for example, they control large swaths of countryside, but there are no major towns in a lot of those places. Is that worth actually the Assad government going in and rooting that out?
I think it is. And they also hold, of course, the west Mediterranean coast of Syria.
Right. Mm-hmm.
This isn't the moment in which he can successfully claim victory and send the troops back to barracks, because the other side isn't going to do that either. So what do you do? I think you just put your finger on it. Look at the remaining urban centers under control of people who are not the Assad regime, and that'll probably be your battle chart going ahead.
My guest today is Ambassador Ryan Crocker. He's a career Foreign Service officer who served as an ambassador to Syria, also most recently ambassador to Afghanistan in 2011 and 12, also served as ambassador to Iraq, to Pakistan, Kuwait, and Lebanon over his long career. He's a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. So this civil war is likely, as you say, I think you made the analogy, said, you know, Lebanon lasted 15 years, and it ended because Syria got tired of it and moved in. Here you have more actors in Syria. You have no Syria to come in and say, put a stop to it. What is the eventual outcome of this? What do you see down the road in this conflict?
Well, first I have to register a protest because you're stealing all of my own good lines here. because that is exactly what happened. Again, 15 years is the norm. Lebanon hit it right on the nose. It will end in a way that we cannot possibly foresee right now. We just don't know. It's a far bigger area than Lebanon. The forces there are far more complex. International interference, there was some in Lebanon, but this takes it right off the charts. So you're going to see a succession of Syrian, Turkish understandings on ceasefire. If you want to bet that the current ceasefire is going to succeed, maybe we could step outside and you can sign me a promissory note right now, because it won't. So you buckle your belt and you stand in for the long haul.
Now, you mentioned Turkey. We haven't really talked a lot about Turkey. Turkey has, at least the last time I saw, they actually have occupied a small slice of northern Syria. They're obviously concerned about Kurdish issues. They're concerned about, the stability of the Syrian regime and the flood of refugees that's coming through their country. What is the Turkish angle for this?
Again, another key question. One of the many gardens we left untended in this administration is Turkey. Started off pretty well between Obama and Erdogan at the early part of the president's tenancy, but that's all gone away. So now you have the Russians and the Turks colluding. Again, utterly unthinkable, but it's happening. So a lot of the unthinkable.
Now, explain that, why that is unthinkable, because the Russian and Turkish enmity goes back a long way.
Centuries.
Yeah.
World War II kind of illustrates the whole complexity of the problem. The Turks kept the Russians out of Turkey during World War II, and boy, was that a high wire act. But they made it work, and then they said, you got to help us. And help came in the form of Turkey being a founding member of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization.
Benefited from the Marshall Plan, if I remember
correctly.
Absolutely.
That was focused on more on Greece than Turkey. And, of course, the Turks didn't suffer war damage.
Right.
But it was the political support that their membership in NATO gave that was, I think, crucial. The Soviets weren't going to mess with that. Yet, along with a lot of other elements of the post-World War II order, NATO's kind of on the ropes. So I come back to my mantra. If the U.S. doesn't lead, no one else will. And our adversaries will simply derive benefit from that. You mentioned the northern border area. The Turks haven't fought a war for a while, and I think they're going to find this one really, really tough. I mean, they're kind of bogged down the town of El Bab, right on the border. The Turkish military has literally been decimated both before and after the 2016 coup. So you don't have that strong institution that was there before. And Erdogan is a brilliant politician, but I think as we watch him, He knows nothing about national security strategy.
Let's talk a little bit about, in our remaining time, about the places where you were intimately involved, most recently Afghanistan and, of course, Iraq. We're not hearing a whole lot about Iraq, except that there's a car bomb that goes off every few days. We're hearing about the liberation of territory that ISIL once controlled, and sort of the battle over Mosul now that's going on. So how stable is the Iraqi state at this particular point?
You cannot even put Iraq and stability in the same sentence.
Okay, maybe not in the same paragraph, maybe.
Right. So what's happened in Iraq? I am fond of saying that in almost 40 years in the Middle East, I learned exactly two things. One of them is be careful what you get into. I learned that one not in Iraq. I learned that one in Lebanon in the early 80s when we decided that an Israeli invasion to get rid of the PLO was a good deal.
Right.
It was not a good deal. Oh. Got rid of the PLO. Who did you get in place?
Yeah.
Hezbollah.
Right.
So, you know, they're gonna have a challenge trying to figure all of this out, or at least to fashion a workable strategy. And I don't think Erdogan is getting great advice. He's effectively purged everybody who was not an Erdogan loyalist, and he brought the army to its knees.
Right. So it's just this crazy purge that took place, and the coup that allegedly or did take place in August or earlier this year.
And at that time, Erdogan, in an unguarded moment, said publicly, this coup attempt is an unbelievable blessing for us. And he went after the Kurds, and we see what we've got. So I just come back to the basic point. 2 decades between World War I and World War II. 7 decades after the end of World War II, it's a world of hurt. But there is no prospect for another global conflict. And the U.S. should get a substantial bit of the credit for that. You know, the joke about NATO, it was designed to keep the Russians out and keep the Americans in. Now we're stepping back. So if 70 years of macro stability, world stability, if we're set to say we're tired of that now, we don't want to do it anymore, then we better be thinking about what comes next, because there are a lot of ways of denominating the conflict in Syria and in the broader region. Yes, it is sectarian, but it's not really about religion. It's about power. So the next administration is going to have to think this through. I think President Trump, it's just hard for me to get my mouth around that.
Right.
There would be another oxymoron, Syrian stability and Trump and policy.
Well.
And in that respect, not kidding here, on international affairs, he and President Obama, pretty darn close.
I think your point is that they're basically about disengaging from this area, or in President-elect Trump's rhetoric during the campaign, it was carpet bombing, you know, or you know, and neither one of those are great policy options. Now, you are a fan of the Defense Secretary designate, General Mattis, correct?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan.
Yeah,
and from what I can tell, I don't know him as well as I know Jim Mattis. Rex Tillotson knows how the world works after all those years as CEO of ExxonMobil. He knows how the Middle East works. So,
now, you're a State Department veteran. You think it's not a horrible idea that the head of ExxonMobil is going to be the next Secretary of State?
Well, given what the alternatives were,
it
could be a lot worse. And I don't know if you paid any attention to his confirmation hearing. Thoughtful, nuanced, and prepared to say that he is not going to be a Trumpist straight down the line. Mm-hmm. And I think he and Jim Mattis are going to be a terrific team.
Mm. Interesting. What are the first steps if they're confirmed and in their positions in charge of the Defense Department and the State Department? What are the first steps? What do you think? If you were advising them, what would you say? What's the first thing you need to do?
First thing you need to do, it would be as difficult as I can imagine, would be to take a page from the George H.W. Bush playbook, because when he sent Secretary of State Jim Baker on his first diplomatic mission, you know, it wasn't to the Middle East, it wasn't to NATO, it wasn't to East Asia, it was right down the street, Capitol Hill. So from January until May of 09, that was Jim Baker's focus. And his message was, we are not Reagan 3, we're Bush 1. We are going to be very different. You're not old enough to remember the great rift that Nicaragua and Central America.
Oh, I do remember, yes. It was Iran-Contra. The Congress felt like it had been misled by the Reagan administration in what happened in support of the Contras and the arms for money for support of the Contras that took place during that.
Why is that important? Why were the measures that Baker, backed by Bush, took significant? Again, to make the point that they were not Reagan III. And who better than the former chief of staff for President Reagan than Jim Baker to make that connection? If they had not done what they did on Capitol Hill, that four-year term of Bush 41 might have had a very different outcome. Because Baker didn't see any of this coming. He just knew it was a dark, ugly world out there and had not improved substantially under Reagan. They got the votes, for example, to liberate Kuwait from the Senate. Margin of 3, but doesn't matter. So that crucial step in world affairs being not dealing with the world, but dealing with your own political divisions, if it was true then, it is gospel now. And much harder to write than was the case back at that time. But that is where the president really needs to focus. We just can't go on this way, not domestically and not internationally.
All right. Well, Ambassador Crocker, we appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Decorated Foreign Service Officer Ambassador Ryan Crocker speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He served most recently, coming out of retirement, to serve as Ambassador to Afghanistan in 2011 and 2012. He's previously served as Ambassador to Iraq, to Pakistan, Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last week. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.